interviewing the leading private equity executives and unlocking the secrets of success. Welcome to the Private Equity Podcast with Alex Rawlings.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Private Equity Podcast. Joining us today is Sandy Dam, previous Managing Director of Sontae and author of SME Globalization. Welcome, and thank you very much for sharing your insights today.
Morning, Alex. Thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
So, Sandy, for those of us who are not familiar with yourself, can you give us a 60 to 90 second breakdown of you, please?
Yeah, my name is Sandy. I'm French-German by blood, British by heart. And I have spent my last 20 years developing international companies, privately owned, family owned, multinationals. In some cases, I've been in charge of turning them around, and in some others, just by multiplying the value for preparing them for an exit. And very recently, I have published my first book called SME Globalization, which explains how SMEs can become very successful on the international stage. But it hasn't always been like this. I was a foreigner wherever I was, and being a minority all your life is not always fun, and mock for my accents, modest origin. I was even broke to some points, but that's all past now, and now I dedicate my life to fixing, improving, and transforming organizations and the teams.
Perfect. Thank you very much. So what one mistake do you see either private equity firms or portfolio companies making, and what actions would you take to correct them?
Yeah, that's a very good question. That's exactly what triggered me to write that book. It's SMEs, PE-backed or not, in general, they all have that common belief that globalization is bad. And globalization only benefits multinational companies. And actually, it's not true. If SMEs, as small as are, play the right cards on the international stage in a very cost-efficient way, they can overperform multinationals and take the full benefit of globalization. It's only about how you play your cards.
Okay, interesting. So when you I know obviously your book's called SME Globalization. So when you say globalization, are we talking about selling internationally? Is that what you phrase the term?
Yes. Well, yeah. It's a full supply chain. Is selling internationally, can design internationally, manufacture internationally, and more importantly, at the core of that is having an international culture, which means integrating foreigners on creating international teams.
Okay. So you mentioned, obviously, the inspiration was partly there, the reasons why you've written your book. So what was the key driver? What was it that made you think, okay, right, I'm going to write a book about this? And what was it that drove you to that SME Globalization title?
Yeah. End of 2019, I had made the decision that 2020 would become the best year of my life. So it was about selling my shares, taking a sabbatical, traveling the world in 80 days, maybe more, writing a book, amongst other things. And well, when 2020 hit, it wasn't much of traveling going on anymore. So being locked down, I said, okay, at least let's write that book. And it's a kind of a journal of what I did at Sontae over the last 6 years, on how Sontae became the company it is now, through the journey with its issues, fears, anxiousness, taking outside people from the comfort zone, and eventually step by step enjoying success on building it up and multiplying the value by whatever the multiplier is.
And so talk to me a little bit about that time at Sontae. Obviously, you grew the business internationally significantly. I think it was 80% of the business was UK focused sales, and then that dropped down to 50% reliance on the UK. Tell us a bit about the story there. Tell us about what you implemented and what happened at Sontae, please.
Yes, Sontae was, I don't think it's only Sontae. I think many, many SMEs I've been talking to do have a bit the same model, meaning when you're a UK company, you say, all right, our home market is UK. And when you ask, we export a lot. Okay, where do you export to? And then the list starts, it's Ireland, India, South Africa, Australia, or Nigeria, on, if you're lucky, a couple of other Commonwealth countries. And what people sometimes forget is, why do people buy from you? In that particular case, it was the service, fast deliveries, contact over the phone, human dimension. And then we start asking the question about, where can we duplicate these key success factors? Is it easy to deliver in 24 hours to Australia, to India, or to South Africa? Oh, no. No, it isn't. Well, so by then, as the UK, we were still part of the biggest single market in the world. I said, well, don't you believe it would be easier to duplicate these key success factors in our neighbor's market? Oh, yeah, you know, we could do, but there's a different language, there's a different currency. And it's a bit this comfort zone who needs to be enlarged on people. And it starts by the board level, on the managing director or the chairman on the board, about how ready they are to go outside the comfort zone and to start doing business in a country where the language is different, where the currency is different, where distribution channels can be completely different as well. But it might still be easier that to do, try to do business in at the other side of the world. And many SMEs, on PE-backed as well, they have this. So many SMEs, PE-backed or not, have these issues about being a bit risk-averse. They prefer to sell in English and in sterling pounds to the other side of the planet, rather than just to adapt a little bit, tweak it, to sell to Germany or to France or to Benelux. That's a common mistake. That's a common mistake many SMEs do. Yeah. But eventually it's linked to the comfort zone, of the management team.
That's interesting. I've never really thought of it. I mean, earlier, if I look at my kind of executive search career, that started off very UK-focused, very regionally-focused, and then obviously internationally later from there. And most of the work that we do is international. So it surprises me to hear that businesses are a bit adverse to, you know, going international and selling into various different places. I'm sure it's easier on a service basis than it is on a product, or more right. Simpler on that basis. So I'm sure there's the lack of comparison there, but definitely dipping toe in the water and pushing that international sales and driving that. What advice would you give then? Obviously, you're mentioning that as a, you know, bit of a stumbling block or a hurdle for a lot of companies to come over. How do they begin that process of looking at how they sell internationally? What were kind of the first steps that you took Sante through to start to change both internally, but also to actually take the action?
Yeah, the first base is on teasing both the board and shareholders is to think about the strategy. To articulate a vision which can be shared. And that vision is, where do we want to be 5 years down the road? What do we want to stand for as a value, as a company? What's our mission? And again, that's what SMEs believe. Oh yeah, but corporate values, mission statements, that's for multinationals. But actually, it's not really true, because that's how you attract talents, especially nowadays with a younger generation coming up who are very purpose-driven and who look for a purpose in their life. So the first step is strategy. Where do we want to go? Where we want to be in 5 years' time? And then what makes us successful? If making us successful in our home market, if it's either the UK or Germany or another country or North America, where can we duplicate what we do in the easiest way possible? And then the second step is to develop internationally. We should look at being the local guys, or making it as easy as possible for local customer, or more comfortable for them. And this leads by hiring international teams, hiring local teams, creating offices or representations, desks in the different countries, having local people who speak the local language. Now with social media, it's pretty easy to come across as being the local guy when you have websites can be easily translated. Okay, it's a one-off shot. It's a bit expensive, but you do it once and then you have it. It's an asset for the rest of the business. Having an address in a country and having phone lines transferred to another place, it's very technology. It's very easy as well. It's extremely cost efficient. I mean, I spoke yesterday to a company and I said, it doesn't cost much. It's less than, altogether, it's less than £100 a month. If you just for having this, for being seen as a local company. And eventually, when you start to have this mixture of culture and language, the culture, the core culture of the company does change, does transform. On one of the motto of my book is diverse teams make better decisions. And that's a mistake which SMEs do PE background on. Germany is very bad at that as well. Is the belief the way the market is, that's the way the rest of the world has to be as well, and must be as well. And so we are going to address it exactly the same way. And that's what doesn't work. That's what doesn't work. And that's where we come back to the comfort zone of the board or the CEO or the managing director, is to let local people do things the way it's done locally. As long as they reach the target, it's fine. But it takes a bit of courage to go outside the comfort zone and to accept that things are done in a different way. And that's where company fail. Yeah. Is they want to impose, and I said the German are particularly bad at that. They want to impose the way it's done in their home countries, they want to impose it exactly in other countries. And that's the biggest hit.
And you mentioned your book title drives along, obviously, SME globalization, but you've got the kind of tagline underneath, which is value in a cost-efficient way.
Yeah.
What advice, getting a bit of an extract from the book maybe, but what advice have you shared in your book that maybe a private equity-backed company could utilize to, as you put it, drive value in a cost-efficient way?
Yeah. When riding the waves of globalization on doing it right, you can get the best of it. From a supply chain perspective, you can start buying components or manufacturing in countries who are specialists in that type of manufacturing. In that case, you get a lower cost. So that's the first benefit. You reduce manufacturing cost. By getting into countries on building global brands, on positioning your products in a high level, you can ask for more money. So it increases your margin on your sales. By looking global in the way I've described earlier, what I call it, in a cost-efficient way, for less than £100 a month, having representation offices, phones, you still have to pay as employees. That's a different thing. But it's a very cost-efficient way to be seen as a local guy, to be a local player, and to build confidence, develop the brand in a very cost-efficient way. So that's your fixed costs, you keep them at a minimum level as well. So by increasing your margin on the sales, by decreasing your manufacturing costs, and by keeping your fixed costs low, right, the EBIT goes up, and so does the company value. And what I like, especially in the PE world, it's project based. You can look for 3 to 5 years. On 3 to 5 years is I think it's a good span to transform a company, and to change the culture, and to build international teams.
Okay. And obviously you mentioned there about hiring and bringing on obviously local individuals. What talent seems to be pretty cost transferable globally. What three attributes do you believe that make a top performer?
A top performer as a sales guy or a top performer as...
Let's go down the sales route.
A top performer in sales should, one, be an expert of his product, an expert of the applications of his customers or his target customers. Should be a networker, because many, many businesses do work like this. And I think, although we have so many who goes via web shop online, I still believe that people buy from people and people like to buy from people. So building relationships, long-term relationships, and standing for what you do, on for what goes wrong. It's very easy to sell when everything goes well. But when something goes wrong, and that's part of real life, especially in the manufacturing or in service as well, when something goes wrong, it's how you step up for it, how you compensate that. There's a big difference on a customer. If something happens bad to a customer, he will always remember how the company reacted about it. It goes extra mile to fix it, or just disappear from the screen. And whatever the industry is, I've seen either reactions on. So that's what I would call the three assets a top sales performer should have.
Perfect. And what do you love about the private equity industry, and equally, what do you dislike or hate about it?
Yeah, what I like about the PE world is that it's limited in time. It's a project, 3 to 5 years. Sometimes can go a bit over. But I do like the 5 years project, which where you have clear targets, a goal, a direction. On the behind this goal, you can build teams, federate them to reach that goal together. And once we are after the 2 to 5 years, make a decision. Say, do we do another 5 years, or do we just leave and do something else? That's that notion of project, which I believe is easier to federate people around from all around the world. What I dislike a bit about the PE world is sometimes some funds can be too short-termist, which means, especially on the international stage, it takes time. That's by experience. When you hire new sales teams in a new country, it takes 18 months until you start to pay back the investment. And in some PE funds, 18 months is just too long. And they would pull the plug after 10 to 12 months. And that's where you geopolize a bit the project on the long-term vision.
Yeah, it makes sense. Well, I suppose when you've got that 5-year time horizon, it can become a little bit short-sighted. But I suppose as long as you've hired the right people and you're making the right steps and looking at those milestones, it's the right it's the right progress from there. So going back a bit, what advice, Sandy, if you're looking back, what advice would you give to your 20-year-old self, please?
Oh, that's very personal, Alex. I believe it would probably be don't listen too much to negative people, or getting rid of the negative people. And I had, God knows, I had my fair share of negative people most of my career. And you will fail by this, you will never succeed that, you will never get that. This will fail, this will not work. We tried it 10 years ago, you won't succeed. And all the holding back which I had, and eventually I did deliver, but it just cost me 2 or 3 times more energy. And it's something now, it probably comes with age as well. I'm just more mindful about, oh, that's a negative guy. I'm not sure I want to work with him. Or that's too negative. I think we underestimate, especially younger people, underestimate how much impact negative people around you can have on you. And yeah, it took me a long time to understand that, to get it. I'm more mindful now.
Yeah, it's a great saying from quote from Jim Rohn. You are the average of the 5 people you spend the most time with.
I never heard that one.
Those people are negative, then it's obviously not going to be beneficial, certainly for you. So, okay. What are your influences? Where do you get your information from? What do you read? What do you watch? What do you listen? Where's your key influences from?
Listening to the news lately is a bit depressing, so I try to keep it short. So the two base informations I like religiously. I do like The Economist weekly because I believe it's probably the most fact-based on neutral source of information. So I value that every week, and I complement it with the Harvard Business Review magazine, which is every 2 months, which is more about managerial insights, new ideas, new concept to work on. On the association of both in general open the door on 1 or 2 books which are trendy or which are in a topic which I should get involved in. But as a source of information, I would call 2 Studio, HBR Review on The Economist for the macroeconomy.
Yeah. Absolutely. And Sandy, if anybody's obviously listening to this and wants to reach out to you, what's the best way that they can get in touch, please?
Well, the easiest is LinkedIn. I'm very active on that. There is the website, which is smeglobalization.com, where the book can be ordered. On there's also an email address. Contact me on. That's the two easiest way. LinkedIn is probably the easiest.
Perfect. Well, Sandy, thank you very much for joining us. I really appreciate your insight. You leave us with lots of value for both PE professionals and portfolio execs to action immediately there. So thank you very much for joining us.
I thank you very much for having me, Alex. And please, whoever listens to us, if they need a hint and advice, just get in touch. I'm happy, more than happy to help and to contribute to make this world a better place.
Perfect. Oh, that's very kind of you. And as always, thank you very much for joining and listening with us today. Should you need any support with either private equity professionals or portfolio executive hiring, please do reach out to me at Raw Selection. If you haven't already, please do subscribe and you will be notified of the next podcast. But till the next time, keep smashing it. And thank you very much for listening.
thank you for listening to the Private Equity Podcast on www.raw-selection.com.